I want to ask you to take your Bible and turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. And we are continuing our study on marriage and the family. And we are going to look at children later, but we're still looking at the marriage. We've been looking at the man. And so today has to do a lot with the man, and I speak primarily to him as the head of the home, but it also has to do with each of us. 1 Peter 3:7, and we back up to the first part. We've looked at this biblically and theologically, and this morning I want to take it into some practical areas. Verse 7 of 1 Peter 3 says, "You husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way." So I want to talk to you this morning about seven areas of marital bliss or conflict. Seven areas in the marriage. Over the last couple of decades, I've done a lot of premarital counseling and a lot of marital counseling. But my premarital has evolved because as I did premarital counseling and at the same time was doing postmarital, or during marital, I guess we should call it, I began to see that the problems that people had were not unique to them, and they fell into seven categories. So I changed my premarital counseling to address the problems that come up in these areas, and then I would give ways of avoiding those problems or ways of correcting them. In other words, we can all do well on the mountaintop, but it's how we deal with problems and whether we diagnose them properly and deal with them properly is whether or not our marriage grows and gets better and gets stronger. So normally, we take several weeks in premarital counseling. We will not do that. I'm going to do it summarily in one session today. I'm going to give you the seven. Therefore, I'm going to be briefer. I'm going to give you an anecdote or a principle or something where normally we would elaborate and I would deal with the man and the woman and how they interrelate. But because of time, we're just going to summarize each of these areas, hopefully to let you know what they are. And these seven areas are not isolated. When you're having problems, and we all do, you have to first isolate where the problem is, diagnose it, and know what the correction to that problem is. And if you don't understand these seven areas, you can think you're having a problem in one area, but that's not really the problem, because these interrelate. They bleed over. They're ramifications. For example, you think you're having trouble maybe in your intimate relationship with your spouse, but you could also be having problems in the area of in-laws, and that's bleeding in there. You could be having problems financially, and yet your intimate relationship you think isn't what it's supposed to be, so you're going and talking to people about that, but the problem is your finances and it bleeding into that area. So I want to give you these seven areas, and again, we're being very brief, and I'm giving them to you in a summarily fashion this morning. Number one is the area of in-laws. In-laws. When you get married, you get your set. And let me say a couple of things, and then we'll say a couple of things you need to practice. A couple of truths are they're going to be there a long time. You need to make the best of it. They're not like your friend down the road, and he had parents, and you knew them for 2 years, and you moved away. Wherever you move, these are there in one form or another. So you need to do things that make the best of this elongated relationship that may last 30 and 40 years and can make or have a great impact upon your marriage. So that's number one. Number two, when you get married, you get a new structure of authority. You are no longer under that authority of what you came out of with your mom and dad. You now have a new structure of authority, and you leave and you cleave. Now, because of those two things, there's two things you should practice. And again, there are others, but this just gives you an idea. Number one, you esteem them. You always honor them. You have a new structure of authority, but you honor them. They may give you suggestions, and I have news for you. If you think when you get married, your parents quit telling you what they think, wake up. We don't quit till we're in the grave. Yes, we have an opinion, and we're going to tell you what it is. And the way you handle it is, you take it very graciously. You don't have to argue. You don't have to say, I don't want to do that. You just take it and say, well, we're going to think about that. That's really good. Because, see, you're not under their authority, but you can honor them by listening. And by the way, they may know something. It may surprise you that they may have learned something along the way. Another thing is, don't have or don't take your fights to your family. And we're going to call them fights. We know they're not. They're just very high-volume discussions that you have in your home as a Christian. But you do not want to go and tell your parents about your fight. The reason is because you go and you tell them, well, yeah, you know, old Bobby just did this and did this. Well, Betty, you know, you're the sweetest little thing I've ever known. That Bob shouldn't treat you. We're all going to slant it to where we look good. Number two, our parents are going to tend to believe that we're the good person. And you know what else happens? You go back that afternoon and old Bob puts his arm around you and he's got a card and he says, honey, I just loved you. And you just melt. And the next day you're over at your parents' house and you're in love again, but they're not in love with your spouse. See, he still hurt their little girl or their wonderful little boy. Listen, let's not put our parents in the position of having to deal with those things. Keep it to ourselves. Make the relationship with your in-laws something that can grow and they don't have a whole bunch of baggage to get over. Number two is the area of finances. And anybody who's been through my premarital counseling, they know it's kind of here that I really become a little bit wild-eyed. So I'm going to try to be composed this morning. First, let me say that 90% of marriages, as I've told you, when they end in divorce, the statistics tell us they are in financial straits. This is so critical to having a good marriage. And anybody who has been in financial straits in their married life knows that it affects the relationship. And by the way, all seven areas I'm talking about, I'm not looking into all the different areas. I'm not giving you financial counseling right now. I'm giving you relational counseling. My emphasis is, how does it affect your relationship? And your finances do. 90%. So we could have a great testimony before the world if Christians got their finances intact in the decrease of divorces that would bring about. Secondly, let me remind you, you and I live in America. It does no good to know that 3 billion of the people, as far as our relationship, 3 billion of the people in the world live on less than $2 a day. That does no good. We live in America. And everything we do, because we are a non-agrarian society, has to do with the exchange of currency. Thus, every day, whether you like it or not, you and your spouse will discuss money at some point. You had to get groceries, you had to get gas, what about this, what about... It's a constant part of your relationship, and that's why I'm saying if it is out of whack, it is going to affect your marital relationship because every time it comes up, it injects pressure that shouldn't be there into your relationship. And I go through this and show how they actually can destroy their marriage, not ever knowing that it was the finances. They really didn't fall out of love, but what happened is they let the finances get out of control, and we don't have time to do that, but I'm telling you it can ultimately destroy it. Now let me mention this. So finances. I want to give you, there are areas of potential disaster with finances, and I'm going to give you four, and there are many others, but let me just give you these four. Number one, a lateral move is disastrous. It is my generation that began the idea that you grew up in a home And when you got ready to move out, you were now living in a three-bedroom home, and they had this and had this, and you were accustomed to that. So when you got married, what'd you want to do? Get a three-bedroom home and get a car and get everything they have. The only way you can do that is to swamp yourself in debt. We forgot that they began in a little efficiency and maybe didn't own their own furniture and maybe didn't have a car, but through hard work, they got this and got this and got this. And when you were a little baby, they had very little. And so now we have young couples making a lateral move rather than going down and starting over. They make a lateral move, and that brings in financial pressures and will ultimately sink your marriage. It can absolutely destroy you. So lateral moves. Second, credit cards. Now, it's not my intent to say credit cards are sinful and everything. My intent is to warn you and to tell you how this can destroy your relationship and you don't even know what's happening. The reason credit cards are such an issue is they are not the same kind of credit as any other credit. They are different. That's why we have more bankruptcies today, in part, than any other time in our history. It's not merely that we've become more greedy and so forth. It is that we have a new kind of credit, a new genre, and that is credit cards. It is not the same kind of credit as buying a car, buying a boat, buying a house, or anything like that, and I want to show you why. Number one, credit cards give you the illusion of having more money. No other credit does that, but they do. And if you'll notice the advertisements, they are advertised in that way. You deserve a vacation. You haven't been able to get away. Here, get this card and you can. The illusion is that when you get that card, you actually have more money. You don't. But that's the illusion. The average credit card balance in America today, and you get seven chances a year on the average to get a new credit card in your home. Seems like I get seven a week, but they say it's seven a year. The average, and I just got this morning off of the American Consumer Crediting Counseling Incorporated, the average credit card balance in America today is $7,000. The average number of cards per family is 10. So they give you the illusion of having more money. Secondly, they are different than any other kind of credit because they have no payoff date and they have no set amount to pay. When you get a credit card, you are not buying something that you know is going to end. You are buying something that never ends, and there's no set payment that you could have worked into your budget. If you go down and buy a car, and I'm not a financial counselor, so you can talk to somebody else whether these are good debts or bad debts. I'm just trying to get you to see that credit cards are different and they can swamp your relationship. You go down to buy a car, he says that'll be $200 a month for 5 years, 10% interest. You buy the car, you know how much interest you're paying, 4.5 years, you say we have 6 months to go. They didn't raise the price on you, it stayed within your budget. Credit cards do not work that way, and they are designed not to work that way. There is no payoff date. I've given you some of these before. One that I got this morning, if you have an $8,000 credit on your credit card, at 18% interest, you make minimum payments, it'll take you 25 years and 7 months to pay it off. 25 years. That'll destroy a good relationship. Another one has a $5,000 minimum. If you pay the minimum on it, it takes you 45 years because they have different minimums. There are some of them that have a minimum that does not pay their minimum required, thus you get penalized every month. Believe it or not. Third, they have a deleterious effect upon you saving for emergencies. So they create the illusion of having more money. They have no way to factor them into your budget because there's no end in the payoff. And the interest rate can change, and that is, by the way, at their discretion, not yours, and you have no recourse, none. And it doesn't matter if you have a good payment record, that's not the issue. So this third thing is they have a deleterious effect upon you saving for crisis. Now, when you've been married for a few years, you understand that what we call crisis really are something that happens about once a month. They're just a part of life. And so what happens with a credit card is you begin to depend upon that for those things. And here's what someone will say when I say, do you have a credit card? Yes, but I'm only going to use it for emergencies. You see, they have already psychologically said, I have this card to take care of emergencies. Therefore, I do not need to save for those emergencies. So it has a deleterious effect. It is difficult for you to fight and save when you have already psychologically conceded that this is the way I take care of emergencies. The fourth thing is that they lead to a credit crunch and you don't know it. There were 1.3 million bankruptcies last year. It is the most in American history. Since the credit card has become popular, bankruptcies have increased astronomically. Part of it is because we are greedy, and I'm not trying to do away with that. Part of it is we don't understand the way credit cards work psychologically and mathematically. One half, 50% of the American households report they have a difficult time paying the minimum monthly payment on their credit cards. 50% of American households today, and I just got this morning, have a difficult time paying the minimum of their credit card. And I don't have time to go through this whole thing, but I want to tell you what the end result is and kind of if you can follow along. But I do this in a more explanatory way when I'm doing premarital counseling. You get married, and let's say you're making $1,000 a month, and so you have a couple of credit cards which you're only going to use for emergency or something that you know you really thought through and so forth. So you go along and you're living on this $1,000 a month, but an emergency comes, a crisis comes, you only use it for that. Finally, you're paying the minimum payment. The minimum payment's $12, $13, doesn't matter. You're living right along. At the end of 10 years, here's what's happened. Several crises have come and different things that you never planned on, and now your credit cards are maxed out. And now they raise your interest to 25%. You can call them about it all you want. It does no good. You say, but I have an excellent credit rating and I never missed a payment. It's irrelevant. If they decide to raise it, they have that power. Read your little agreement. It's a handy little thing to read, by the way. They raise it to 25%. You can't charge anymore. Here's what happened and you didn't recognize. You were spending $1,000 a month plus if you took the amount that your credit card now you owe on it after 10 years, if you took that and divided it up for 10 years, you were getting $100 a month off of it. Now, you didn't do it every month, but if we just divided it up, so you were taking $100 a month off of that. Now you're going to have to pay them $100 a month, plus they increased your interest. So what you now have is $250 less a month, all of a sudden, to expend in your marriage, meaning that your income, your expendable income, decreased 25% after you've been married for 10 years, and your relationship is all of a sudden in jeopardy because you are in financial straits of barely making the minimum payment for the next 25 years. See, the $100 you have to pay them, the $100 you were used to getting that you no longer get from the credit card, and the higher interest. It'll absolutely destroy you. And it slips up on you. When people say, I'm so far in debt, I can't get out, did you know that they're not exaggerating? This happens and it balloons out at the end. So, a third area that you have in finances problem is allowing the generous person in your marriage to manage the checkbook. The generous person, you'll be able to tell them because they always will buy something for someone somewhere. If you let them manage the checkbook, you know what they'll do? They'll always buy something for someone somewhere, and you'll be broke. Fourth is not giving systematically and sacrificially to God's work. And again, besides all the biblical principles, let me just say this. The reason we don't do that is because of self and greed. We have a greed problem that we won't give to God first, and we want our self needs to be satisfied. Those two things are at the heart of your problems within marriage. So when you're unwilling to give to God, it's not that you're just mismanaging or anything like that. And besides all the other biblical things, it is that you are doing and feeding the very thing that is destructive in a relationship, and that is narcissism. So by not giving to God and making that a priority where He is the center of your home and everything you do, you are still rivaling one another for who's the center, and one day it will come to a warfare. So finances. The third area is personality. Now personalities draw us to one another, but lo and behold, they become areas of conflict. And you marry people who have a different personality than you. That's what attracts us. And what you have to do is keep thinking about their strong points, not the weaknesses. And you're going to be different, and it's going to become more pronounced as you stay married. I remember, just as a way of this really hitting home one time, Gene and I took a class together, and we only took one class together, by the way. This ended it. And we were in the class, and we did homework one time together. We thought that'd be such a romantic idea. Wasn't any romance there at all. But we sat in class, and I remember this went on for several days, and at different times she would ask something like, You feeling all right? And so, you know, maybe next day she'd say, are you mad? No, I'm not mad. And, you know, I don't know what's going on. And so then she said, do you like Dr. Pretlove? I said, you know, he's one of my favorite professors. And I'm just flipping out. What's the deal here? What's the third degree? Well, it's personality. See, if I get in a class and I really like the professor and I really like the content, I become pathologically focused. And I'm writing notes and listen. Gina is having an interactive experience. She's in her chair and everything he's saying... and she's... By the time we've left, she's interacted with everybody in the room. Yeah. So she looks over at me and thinks, I'm mad. I'm just focused on what we're doing. See, it's a different personality. Different personality. So it attracts us to one another, but we well know if we're married that at some point it begins to rub. You have to go back and remember what attracted you. What it is there that is different from you that makes it great. The fourth area is gender, men and women. We've said many times men and women are different, contrary to what those that want us to think. Men and women are different. Now, this for people who've been married for 10 or 20 years is like redundancy. It is they know it. They don't care what all the studies say. They don't care what happens in a laboratory. They live it. We're different. What you've heard a lot of is the androgynous male. I want to remind you that is a secular psychological term, not a biblical term nor a biblical idea. What androgynous means is that you are male and female. And so the push today is to get men more in touch with their female side, their tenderness and emotions and all of this. But I remind you, this is not a biblical concept. It is not a biblical idea nor biblical terminology. What they're saying is there are only two parts. There's your male side and your feminine side, and we've got to get the man more in touch with his male side. Notice it's always skewed away from the male aspect. But let me tell you the biblical side of this is. The biblical is there's a human dimension which is shared by both male and female. And the male and female have these human characteristics. And sometimes the male has certain characteristics that the woman doesn't have, but sometimes it is the degree to which the male or the female has those characteristics which characterizes them as a male or a female. In other words, by God's design, He made us to fit the role He created for us. You have to understand secular psychology and secularism does not recognize created roles. We were created as men to be the provider, to be the protector. And thus, some of our makeup fits that. The woman was designed to be the helper and the nurturer. And she is made up to do that. And so it is not that we are to get in touch with our feminine side. The Bible never says that. We are to be human, created in the image of God, and men are to be men, women are to be women, both in the way God's created us and the roles in which we walk. Now, let me give you some areas, and you know them. Amount of talking. Women talk more than men. And there are so many scientific studies and longitudinal studies, but I've done my own. And you can just do it with me. We can all join in together. I'm just going to challenge you. Just drive down the road, and every time you see a car acting odd, and you get up beside it, they're on the phone. My studies so far reveal 98.5% of them are women. One day I was coming to church and Gina was leaving. And I passed her. She didn't see me, but she was on that phone. And you know what? When I left, she was coming back down Robinson. We passed. You know what she's doing? On the phone. I get behind cars and they act odd, like the light turns green and they just sit there. They're on the phone. 98.5% are women. Just check it out. Men don't talk as much. Today we're telling men you have to talk more. And all of the things, because they bought into secular androgyny, even within Christian circles, nowhere do they find this in the Word of God. Men, you need to talk more. You need to talk more. Listen, ladies, may I say, with all due respect, talk less sometimes. Sometimes. Sometimes we need to talk more, but the fact of the matter is sometimes a little less would help. Last night we were eating with Don and Terry Paul, and I had taken Nancy to the doctor on Friday. Gina couldn't take her, and she said, "Now when you take her, you be sure and go in there so you hear what the doctor said. Go in there with her." And I said, "I will." She said, "I want to know what he said." I said, "Okay." So I did. I went in there, listened, you know, the whole bit. So we're sitting there eating, and Don and Terry ask about Nancy, and Gina's telling them what the doctor said. Now, we haven't talked yet. So she's telling them what the doctor said. And then she looked at me and she said, "You never did tell me what he said." She said, "What did he say?" I said, "Basically what you just got through saying." I didn't add a dimension to what she already knew, because Nancy would give her a far fuller picture than I could. We just talk less. Men talk less. Now, we need to talk more sometime, but sometimes we need to talk less. The content of our conversations is different. Men and women are different. You arrive, you got the two children, you arrive at your in-laws, you get out of the car. Have you ever heard the woman say, "Man, I'll tell you, we got 18 and a half miles a gallon on the road there driving. We were keeping her under about 70, though. And that's without the air conditioner." And the mother-in-law goes, "I bet it has something to do with those tires. You got good tires?" We never have heard it. Ever. You know why? Because women don't care about that. They go in the house and they're talking about children and life and all these critical issues. And 30 minutes later they go, "Are y'all coming in yet?" And the father-in-law goes, "Why don't you show me these tires out here? We're talking about them." Our conversations, the content is different. And listen, we're not being tortured. We're very happy. You must understand, we're happy. When we're talking about the tread on tires, this is not some fake thing. We're really happy about it. We're having a great time. It's you who are making us think we must be miserable. All these years, I've been tire miserable. Content's different. Third, the depth of our conversations can be described sometimes as shallow. The other day, Pete and Prudy Van Dyke and I were standing talking, and we were kind of having this conversation, and Prudy, you know, I said something. She said, "Y'all can't be that shallow." I said, "Yeah, we are. We really are, and we're real happy with it. You're the ones that want to keep taking us deeper and deeper. But man, we're just happy up here, shallow as we can be." We watch a football game and we just watch it and moan and groan. But we don't have to talk about all our relatives and all of these things. See, we're different. And God made us that way. Just the facts, ma'am. Fifth, intimacy. I deal with this a little differently in that context, but here, suffice it to say, that a man and a woman's view of intimacy is very, 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 very different. And you're not going to change it by complaining to one another or trying to make the other view it the way you do. It is not going to happen because God has made us different. And in this area, which is supposed to be a great area of marriage, it becomes an area of perpetual conflict and dissatisfaction because the woman wants the man to view it the way she does, and she wants, and he wants her to view it the way he does. And my simple response is, this is a place to begin ministry, where the man says, I don't care if I don't understand the way she views it. I don't care if I value it the way she does. What I'm going to do is minister to her, and I'm going to make it where she enjoys this time. And she does the same thing, and it works out, and you remove yourself from the middle of it. It has to become a place of ministry where you put the other person first. The sixth area is courting. Courting, an old word for dating or so forth, what you do before you get married. Well, you know what you do when you date, and even if you're trying to look casual, you still got to look a neat casual. I mean, there's only a certain shirt you would have worn. You'd have had to have the right pants, the right tennis shoes. You just have to look a certain way. Somewhere down the line, that gets lost, and it looks like Frankenstein met the bride of Frankenstein in our home. If people that didn't know us came into our home and saw us the way we look, we'd scare 20 years off their life. Now, that's okay because you both have gone through the downgrade together. But as far as your relationship, you got to dress up. You've got to dress up. And what I mean by dressing up is you did this courting because you knew they had, the girl had said, I like that shirt. So the guy shows up every week with the same shirt. Because he wants to impress you. So you're thinking about, what could I wear that my mate would like? Because you're courting. And so men, if you ever dress yourself alone, you've picked it all out yourself, God forbid, and you're walking out the house, you're going to eat, you know, and you come in there and she says, you going to wear that? Say, no, I was just wearing it till I walked back here and changed and got ready. Don't ever tell them you were going to wear it. That's just something you put on in the interim before you really got dressed. There are several brother-in-laws in my family and five of us. And one day we were at Christmas, all the nieces and nephews were there at Gina's mom and dad. And four of the older ones, we'd been married somewhere between 10 and 20 years apiece. And we were all just sitting drinking coffee. And my youngest brother-in-law, Gina's brother, Eddie, he comes in the house. He'd just been married for 4 years. And so he sits down with us, you know, and he kind of looks dejected and everything. And so he said, what's going on? He said, just women. He said, I don't know what to do. We said, well, what happened? Oh, he said, Glenn's mad at me. What's going on? I don't know what's wrong. He said, what happened? Well, he said, I didn't get her Christmas present. He said, well, Eddie, what led you to that fine conclusion? He said, oh, about a month ago we were talking and she said, well, just don't get me a Christmas present. So I didn't. Oh, he looked at him like a nut that just fell out of a tree. I mean, and you think men are matter of fact? He's matter of fact to a man. We said, Eddie, when she said don't get her a gift, the best thing you could have done is either got the biggest gift you'd ever gotten or two of them. He said, what? We said, that means you really better get a gift. Well, why don't she say what she means? Well, you're in the area now that we can't explain. And God is my witness. We're sitting there, and finally he gets up, and he's leaving. We say, where are you going? Hunting. This is Christmas Day. I said, Eddie, why are you going hunting? Gwen said to, why don't you just go hunting? Now, there are several things, Eddie, that you don't want to do today, but the top of the list is you dare don't want to go hunting. What you want to do is go get you two big gifts and go back home. You see, you can't forget the courting. You can't forget the courting. If you do, when you come to the time when your children are gone, you're going to have problems. I have counseled people time and time and time and time and time and time again. It is like a broken record. Matter of fact, I do something in that to show them I could predict their response. And I write stuff in an envelope and give it to my secretary or something so that I don't have it before I meet with them. And I can tell them what the response is going to be to my counsel to them. They've been married 10, 15, 20 years. They're having problems in their marriage. They don't really get along. They don't know if they love each other and all of these things. And so one of the things I say is, how long has it been since the two of you went somewhere alone, like to a cabin on the lake or something where you spent time alone, away from the children, like you did when you first got married? Oh, golly, Ronnie. I guess it's before we had children. When those children are gone, you may not survive when it's just two of you again. What you're doing is building your relationship that was begun by God to be two and have some others join in, but it was never to replace or subjugate the relation between the two. So you have to keep dating and keep courting, and you have to get away from the children, period. I remember we'd do that, and my little girls go, we want to go, we want to go. It's not fair y'all are going to the lake. It's not fair. We want to be able to go with you, you know. And we'd say, well, you're not going. You're not welcome. You can't come. We're going to have fun, and it's going to be without you. And so, man, they try to make you feel so guilty. When we'd come back, Natalie'd go, what'd y'all do, smooch? See, they really like knowing that their mom and dad's in love. They really like knowing that. If you come to the time when your children are all gone and you have not maintained that twosome, you may not make it through that time. The last area is spiritual, your spiritual life. Let me just say that this has to do with your relationship with God. The most important thing that happens in your marriage, almost all marriage seminars begin with communication, understanding one another. That is not the place to begin. The place to begin is the wife and the husband's individual relationship with God. The most important thing that I bring to my marriage is my relationship to God, and Gina also, apart from each other. Because if my relationship with God is not right, then when I've done her wrong, I won't go back and ask for forgiveness. I won't try to grow and correct my ways, and on and on and on it goes. I won't try to communicate. I won't try to understand. It is that relationship with God, when you've had a little rough spot, you get away and you say, but God, I want to walk with you, and you gave me this mate, so what do I need to do? And it keeps your heart tender where you keep that relationship going. So the first thing, and this can be very simply demonstrated, if the husband was walking perfectly with God and the wife was walking perfectly with God, we would not have the selfish conflicts. So one of us or both of us are not doing what we ought to be doing at that time. That's why your individual is most important. So you have to grow as an individual with God. Secondly, you have to grow together. So it's not an either or. It is not, do I have a personal Bible study or do we do it together? It's not either or. It is together and it is individual. And when you do this together, if you don't, what you'll find is one of you has grown here and one is here. And in the most vital area of your relationship, which impacts every area of your relationship, you are out of sync. And thus you will begin to look for confidants and so forth that are in that area that you can relate to. You have to grow together spiritually, and that is generally. You don't have to do everything exactly the same. This is one of the problems I have with some of the male bonding groups that we have, and I don't know if you've read the literature and the books and so forth, but there's a couple of problems. One of them is that you get with other men and you share with them things you wouldn't share with anybody else. I want to tell you something. I don't share anything with anybody else that I wouldn't share with my wife, my confidant, my soulmate that God gave me to be one with. If women knew that their husbands were getting involved sometimes in groups where they're supposed to share the most intimate sexual details of their marital relationship, etc., etc., I believe those women would be saying, I don't think that's such a good idea. I'm just saying that God has given us a soulmate that we can bear our soul with. That is the part of the growing experientially. There are things that Gene and I talk about I wouldn't talk about with anybody, nor she. We've come to the day when we're in the Oprah mentality. If it happened to you privately, go on television and talk about it. There are just some things that stay within the confines of a marriage, and we say within a family. And so we are focused upon growing together spiritually three ways. The Word of God. You have to grow in your knowledge of the Word of God together. Again, one of you may surpass in one area, but if you're going to build your marriage around this, you have to understand the Word of God and how it applies to different areas. Second, in the work of God. People who serve God will always grow faster and to a greater degree than those that don't. You cannot really grow spiritually unless you are serving. There is a retardation that happens. But as you serve, you grow. So you work together. Maybe it's in the same area of ministry, but maybe it's in two different areas, but at least you're able to share the commonality of being involved in the work of God. Third, in the worship of God. That your worship experience, I'll bet you if I did a private survey, and I would be included in this, that we have come to church on Sunday sometimes when our relationship was strained. And in the experience of worship, of getting before God and worshiping Him, all of a sudden one reaches over and just grabs the other's hand. And it's all okay. We didn't have a big dialogue. A lot of things didn't happen. But what did happen is we both got into the presence of God and got right with God, and somehow those things, they just kind of melted. And we leave there like one. You see, you worship together, you work together, and you learn the Word of God.